VoiceAmericaHealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
People are killing, they'll do anything. Fill their bodies with poison things just to feel good. Just to feel good. And why must everything I learn be so hard? Can't you see I'm giving up? I don't know where you are. Where are you? Oh, when black clouds come over me, they darken my skies. If it's how I look at things, to give me new eyes.
Do you or someone you know suffer from addiction? While many of us have an addiction to something, we have few places to turn to get the help we need. Welcome to Addiction in America with Rebecca Bullion. Learning about addiction and that you are not alone is the first step in getting things back on track. Our show will bring you to that first step and much more. Now, here is Rebecca Bullion.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to Addiction America on Voice America Internet Talk Radio, and I'm Rebecca Bullion. And today I'm so happy to have interventionist Burr Cook as our guest speaker. Hello, Burr. How you doing?
Doing fine, Rebecca.
Well, I just appreciate you being here to kind of help us understand more about intervention. The topic for today's show is why do intervention? May I ask you to entertain that question first?
Sure. An intervention is meant to raise the bottom that we always hear about addicts needing to hit bottoms, and we hear about the consequences of addiction, and an intervention is meant to raise that bottom to stave off the physical, mental, emotional, legal, and financial consequences, just to name a few, that accompany addiction. So we do interventions to prevent further damage for the individual and their family and everyone else they have a relationship with.
Oh, yeah. I have heard people say so many times, oh, the person has to hit their bottom and they have to want treatment. They have to want to get clean. And, it seems like addicts are kind of unwilling and stubborn, and maybe part of them wants that, but How do you motivate them in the process of intervention to get to treatment?
Sure. Well, intervention is a process, and so and I like to say every intervention has a life of its own, and every family or business you might be doing an intervention for has particular circumstances, and so everything starts with an assessment of what are the circumstances here. As far as motivating them into treatment, it's not just the effort of the interventionist. A lot has to do with the family that you're working with, and they have a job to do as well. The interventionist educates and trains the family so that they're able to do that job. Back to hitting the bottom, addicts will go through many bottoms. One of the hallmarks symptoms of addiction is loss of control, and another is persistent use despite negative consequences. So it's almost like an addict is on a set of rails, and they're just going to keep going until something dramatic happens to help them stop.
Yeah. So I've heard this term family recovery. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Well, family recovery is. It's meant to address the problems that occur in a family. Any family living with addiction kind of gets sucked into the vortex of addiction, so to speak. They start to adapt and compensate for this uncontrollable behavior. in ways that, that really tie the family in knots and changes the family system in ways that are unhealthy. They cope with addiction, but oftentimes they cope in unhealthy ways. So family recovery is meant to address the needs of the individual family members so that they can participate in their own recovery process along with the addict. We discovered, you know, years and years ago that just treating the addict, we didn't get the kind of results we were looking for. And it occurred to some professionals that the entire families were unhealthy as a result of living with addiction and that the family needed help too. So family recovery is really meant to address the entire system.
Well, you know, it sounds like that the intervention process could actually take some time to get the whole family ready to do the intervention. How much time have you found on average it takes before intervention day?
You know, I would say anywhere between 20 and 40 hours. Again, everything starts with an assessment. The way I work, I like to talk to each person participating in the intervention, interview them, and do an assessment with them individually. Again, it depends on the model you're using as well. Sometimes the process of intervention is in a systemic family intervention is really a workshop format, and so the entire family is participating in a workshop, and that typically takes 2 full days. And there is a little preparation that goes into that beforehand. And then, of course, after the intervention, with the understanding all of this is a process, not just the intervention, but treatment and recovery is a process. Families need a lot of support throughout that process. So after the intervention, there's time that goes into it as well.
Hey, on a side note, I think I saw somewhere that you had started one of those workshops in your practice.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about that for a second?
Yeah, the Center for Family Recovery is in the concept really was kind of a hybrid of a systemic family intervention workshop and a family program that a treatment center might have, and it's meant to address the educational needs for families about addiction and about recovery, and also to take a look at the things that happen within a family system that are self-defeating, the coping mechanisms and so forth that families adapt with. And so we address topics like codependency and enabling, and we address the concept of recovery to help families understand that this isn't just about an addict getting treatment, but that the entire family can benefit from getting treatment. And so the workshops teach healthy boundaries and healthy communication skills, and there's some experiential stuff that goes on to help families learn these concepts and practice these concepts.
I guess that parallels the name of your intervention business. It's called Family Intervention Now. I like that. That's good, because now is a good time to do an intervention if you're thinking about it. Do you ever tell people to wait to do an intervention for some reason?
Occasionally. Oftentimes, families, when I get a call, families will really want to do the intervention yesterday, or I'll get a call that we're doing an intervention at 6 p.m. tonight, and we're told that we need to have you there. And I don't work that way. I tend to want to slow families down, provided there are no significant safety issues. But I like to slow families down, get them out of crisis mode so that they can focus on the process and not the outcome. Sometimes families just aren't ready to do an intervention until they've had a significant amount of education and preparation.
I guess families can hit bottom too, just getting sick and tired of being sick and tired. I love that phrase.
Sure.
Let's go back to talking about the models. And when I became an interventionist, people would say, well, what model do you use? And I always wondered, well, I guess that's really important. People think about that. What is the surprise model? What happens in the surprise model versus what you said earlier, the systemic or the systems model?
Sure. Well, the surprise model has gone through a lot of evolution, originally starting out as a confrontative process. It's more of a carefrontative process now. It's certainly a lot more loving and not as harsh. But this is a model where an interventionist gets together and has families write letters that are going to be read at the intervention, and letters that basically address how addiction is impacting the family, how they see addiction impacting the individual they're concerned about, and what they want to do about it. It's a rather quick process. Most interventionists today using this process do put more education and preparation into it than the original model, but it is a surprise model. The addict does not know this is coming. So there's a lot of tension, and people are rather nervous with this process. And sometimes they feel guilty about that approach and that process.
I understand. I have heard that a lot. And it seems like that guilt and the fear add in another layer to the intervention. If you were using the other model, I think I heard you call it the systems model or the invitational model. How does that model work?
Well, the systemic family intervention is an invitational model where the family starts talking about addiction in their family, with oftentimes something they haven't been doing, and talking about wanting to get help for the entire family. There is a process that goes into the invitation, but essentially what happens is that the addict is invited to participate in a workshop along with the rest of the family members to see how addiction has impacted the family and what it is everyone can do about it. Within the model, the focus is not on the addict. Unlike the surprise model, the focus is on addiction and the effects it's having on the entire family. So there's a lot of shame reduction right there where the addict isn't necessarily in a hot seat. They may feel like it, but they're not in this process. They're not in the hot seat. They're not the focus. The family and family health is the focus.
And so everybody is kind of owning their stuff and working on it. Do you refer family members for outside treatment?
Absolutely. Occasionally, I'll refer family members to outside treatment before they participate in the intervention process because there's just that much work that needs to be done. But certainly with any intervention I do, regardless of the model, everybody is going to leave that intervention with their own recovery plan, a specific plan for things that they could be doing that will help get them back on track, get them moving towards having a healthier family system.
Okay. What do you do if one of the members of the team is also addicted?
Well, the beauty of the systemic family intervention is that because it's addressing what's going on with everyone in the family, oftentimes you will have more than one person go into treatment. Frequently, it is the case that there is more than one person that's having a problem with either substances or harmful behavior, and that can be addressed in a treatment plan. I've had as many as three people go into treatment as a result of one intervention workshop. So that can be addressed. Doesn't mean everyone will go, but there's a good chance that everyone will, because there's consensus at the end of those workshops that the family is going to choose health and that everyone individually is going to do their part to become a healthier family member.
Okay. Well, listen, I've got a few more questions that I want to ask you, but how about let's go to break first. Again, listeners, if you want to call in during the second half of the show, dial 866-472-5792, and you can ask Burr some questions. So thanks for listening in, and let's go to break.
Great.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
please visit Rebecca's website at www.addictioninamerica.com to get more information on today's show, our guests, and other resources. The website contains a bookstore of material by various authors, musicians, and instructional videos to download. Applications for case management, referrals, and intervention can be made through the bookstore as well. Be sure to visit addictioninamerica.com. Addiction in America is here to help you take control of your life. The website again is www.addictioninamerica.com.
Are you feeling slammed and suckered in today's stock market? If so, then you need to tune in to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, Jordan Kimmel will train you in what you can do to beat up the big boys on Wall Street, as well as share his secrets to success so that you can buy and sell like a profit-pumping pro. Grab the bull market by the horns and listen to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to Addiction in America with Rebecca Bullion. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to Rebecca at addictioninamerica.com. Again, that's Rebecca at addictioninamerica.com. Now, back to the show.
Well, welcome back. We've got Burr Cook Interventionist that we're talking with today, and it looks like we have a caller on the line, David.
Hi, Burr. I've got a question for you. What does it usually cost to do an intervention, and what all is involved in that?
Sure. Well, the cost varies with the interventionist, of course, and their experience. I know people that do interventions for as little as $500. Some charge up in the $65 to $7,500 range. Every interventionist has got their own model that they use. What that buys you, basically, David, is that I'm going to do an assessment so that we can plan the intervention appropriately and plan the treatment scenario for the individuals we're concerned about. But it also includes up to a year or more of support. I don't put a time limit on how long I work with families. But it buys your support to guide the family through the process of treatment, ongoing recovery. Families need a lot of support at this time, particularly when a person comes home from treatment. And so that's included in the price is that guidance and support and direction that an interventionist will provide for the family so that they can move beyond treatment into their own personal recoveries.
Are there statistics that show intervention actually make more successful situation than people who are participating in a family approach tend to stay clean or sober longer?
Well, there are, and I don't know the exact numbers, but you know, healthy families are made up of healthy family members, and so if you have an interventionist that is guiding the family towards family health. You know, addiction is very difficult to sustain in a family that's getting healthier. So we do see better outcomes with this.
Great. David, thank you so much. Is there any other question before we get back to talking to Burr?
No, that's it. Thank you. That's what I wanted to know.
Thank you, David.
Thank you so much for calling in. Burr?
Yes.
I guess that brings up a question for me that I have been asked a lot is people are talking about the cost of treatment, the cost of intervention. I guess it can get pretty pricey. And, you know, how do you get involved with, you know, helping families who can't afford as much as others?
Right. Well, part of our job as interventionists is to know what sort of treatment is out there and available so that we can meet specific needs that families have. Treatment can be expensive, but there's also free and low-cost treatment centers out there. It's our job to know about them, who's doing what, so that part of our referral, beyond what's clinically appropriate for an individual, is to make a financially appropriate referral. And so it's part of our job as interventionists to be able to meet the needs of families that just don't have that many resources.
Okay. Hey, I hear people talk about inpatient versus outpatient treatment. And what's some of your feedback on when you'll use outpatient versus inpatient?
Mm-hmm. Outpatient, I'm more comfortable using outpatient with an individual that's highly motivated and mature, and depending on what sort of substances they're struggling with. I'm more open-minded to outpatient with those types of individuals. If I have a 20-year-old heroin addict that's having a difficult time getting off heroin and is not that motivated, I wouldn't consider outpatient for that person. I think that's inappropriate, and that they wouldn't be able to stay clean and sober through the process of outpatient.
That kind of gets into a question that I've had recently about the use of the synthetic opiates like Suboxone to help people with their withdrawals from opiates. What do you find to be the case with Suboxone and somebody maintaining good sobriety?
Mm-hmm. Well, Suboxone, I think, is a useful tool for detox and occasionally for individuals where what we're the best we can hope for is a harm reduction scenario. In other words, they may use Suboxone as a maintenance drug, much in the same way methadone has been used. But my feeling is that it's a drug that's abused quite a bit. It's highly addictive. People have a very difficult time getting off of it. And there is a financial incentive to putting people on Suboxone. I've seen many individuals struggle with getting off Suboxone once they get on. So I have kind of strong feelings about it. I think being on any medication is difficult to fully participate in your own recovery process, but there are a few cases where it is appropriate to use.
I've heard that the way that Suboxone works chemically is that you've got a receptor cell in the brain and that Suboxone fills up part of it with the synthetic opiate and then blocks the rest of it, so that if somebody were to use just regular opiates on top of it, they wouldn't be able to feel the effects of that. Is that how it works?
Well, that's how it works with Suboxone, which has naloxone and buprenorphine in it. There is a form of buprenorphine, which is the active ingredient in Suboxone, called Subutex, that does not have the opiate blocker. This is a drug that's much more abused than the Suboxone. But that's one of the benefits to Suboxone is that it does make it difficult to overdose or experience the effects of using other opiates like heroin or pain medications on top of it.
So do you have any, you said your clients that have used it have had less success. I'm just curious, is it possible, you said they can't overdose, but if somebody uses regular opiates with Suboxone, what happens?
Typically what I hear is that they feel little or no effect of the opiate, trying to get the effect that they get with opiate usage. They don't feel the euphoria or the kind of just being loaded, basically. They don't get loaded on it is the major complaint.
So that could create a really bad scenario for the addict. If they wanted to feel the effect of the regular opiate, but they continue to use Suboxone, they could overdose on opiates without feeling it?
Well, they typically we don't see people overdose to the point they can take too much, but there's a ceiling effect with the Suboxone, so that after about 24 milligrams, you're not going to get much more effect. It does set up problems for people that are actually trying to get high, because eventually the drug will wear off, and it depends on what other drugs you're doing. If you continue to take a lot of drugs, particularly if you're mixing a drug like, let's say, a form of benzodiazepine with the opiates, it can definitely set up problems for you down the road. We've had lots of overdoses where Suboxone has been involved. But my experience in working with addicts is is that if they want to get the effects of opiates, they'll stop taking the Suboxone to make that happen.
Yeah, I understand. I understand. What are some of the, like, be careful, watch out fors with some of the addictions that people have, like particularly alcohol and benzodiazepines like Xanax or Valium? What
sure.
is this, the danger with those two combined?
Well, the danger is these drugs potentiate each other. In other words, that by combining the drugs, you make the effect much greater as far as not just euphoria, but this being loaded. And, you know, frequently people overshoot the mark. They can go into cardiac arrest or respiratory depression. And so we frequently see opiate users using benzodiazepine along with the alcoholics. You know, the alcoholics are experiencing depression and anxiety as a result of their addiction to alcohol, and they'll go see their doctor and minimize their alcohol use and get put on a medication to help with anxiety, and now they're taking both alcohol and the benzodiazepines. Opiate users, same thing. Opiate users build a tolerance so quickly to the opiates that they're using that they find if they can potentiate the opiate effect with taking benzodiazepine, it's a much better high for them in their mind. But what happens is they're setting themselves up for a potential overdose. Very dangerous. Very dangerous.
And I just see such a trap for families there if they do have an addict that's seeking psychiatric help and they get you know given antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications that can be harmful to them in a way, some of them, but it's such a trap. How do they gauge the difference between what is a psychiatric issue and what is an addiction?
You know, that's a great question, Rebecca. And if we know that somebody has an addiction and they may have a psychiatric disorder or vice versa, it's really important to get appropriate treatment. So that let's say somebody goes into detox, goes into a treatment center, gets off the drugs. So then they, you know, once they're off the drugs, you're going to get a clearer picture of what's going on with them psychiatrically. These the mental illness and the drug addiction tend to cloud each other, and I think it's important to get people clean and sober and properly evaluated, you know, after they've been clean and sober for a while, so that we can see what we're really working with.
Okay. All right. Well, hey, I think it's time to go to break again. And callers, I invite you to call in, ask for any questions that you have. The number is 866-472-5792. And this is Rebecca with Addiction in America.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Please visit Rebecca's website at www.addictioninamerica.com to get more information on today's show, our guests, and other resources. The website contains a bookstore of material by various authors, musicians, and instructional videos to download. Applications for case management, referrals, and intervention can be made through the bookstore as well. Be sure to visit addictioninamerica.com. Addiction in America is here to help you take control of your life. The website again is www.addictioninamerica.com.
We all want peace. We all desire a more meaningful life. We work hard to achieve these things, but at what avail? The key is authentic living with Andrea Matthews. Andrea will interview some of the great spiritual experts of today and will provide wisdom to help you raise your consciousness to the level of your own I Am. Your authenticity can give you miraculous gifts, but you have to know how to get there. Listen for Authentic Living with Andrea Matthews. Heard live every Wednesday afternoon at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Pacific Time on the Seventh Wave Network.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to Addiction in America with Rebecca Bullion. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to Rebecca at addictioninamerica.com. Again, that's Rebecca at addictioninamerica.com. Now, back to the show.
Well, welcome back. And again, I've got Burr Cook of Family Intervention Now that we're interviewing today. And just to pick up with the conversation, Burr, I wanted to know, what are some of those self-defeating or unwritten rules that go on in a family system when there's an addiction?
Sure. The things we typically see is because there is a lot of shame centered around addiction and a lot of confusion, and we see addicts who basically cannot control their behavior. One of the first things we see is what we call the no-talk rule. Families stop talking about what's going on. They'll talk about the little things. The little things become big deals, and the big deals, the real important stuff, people stop talking about. This is where you have families walking on eggshells, afraid to address the elephant in the living room. And so one of the first rules we see is people stop talking about what's really going on. And
Hey, listen, we've got caller Joanne on the line. Joanne?
Okay. Hello?
Yes, thanks for calling in, Joanne.
Hi.
Hi, Joanne.
What questions do you have for us today?
I have a daughter that was in rehab. She addicted to Xanax. She was in rehab for 30 days last year and then relapsed recently and went to another rehab this year and just got out 2 weeks ago and left with some people from rehab for 2 weeks. And she's agreed to go into sober living. That's the only way we're going to support her, but she's wanting to come home for a few days first, and everybody is telling us, don't let her come home before she goes to sober living, and I just would like to know your opinions about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, my opinion is that, you know, we like to see people go to sober living after treatment. We like to see longer treatment than 30 days whenever possible, particularly when a person's using Xanax. We like this transition to be as seamless as possible. Stopping off on the way to go home can set you up for all kinds of problems, as you know, and it sounds like you have a little fear about her coming home. And so I understand that fear, and it's well-founded. I think when people are in these recovery transitions, they need to stick to the recovery transitions without too many stops on the way, unless there's a very, very, very good reason for her to come home. I would suggest that she goes, directly into sober living and continue with the recovery process.
Okay, so it's okay if we meet her somewhere to take her to it and set a boundary and say you can't come home first, but we'll meet you and then get you there?
Sure.
Okay. That's my question. Thank you.
Thanks, Joanne, and thanks for listening in. So, Burr, back to you. What about that question of boundaries? What are some of the boundaries that families might, I know that's a real general question, but what are some of the boundaries that they would want to set in trying to get a healthier family system going?
Sure. Well, I think, first of all, they need to understand the concept of boundaries and how to effectively set boundaries. It's more than just drawing a line in the sand, so to speak. And this is where families need a lot of help in understanding, what sort of boundaries are appropriate for me, and it really begs the question of what do I need to feel safe? what do I need to have peace of mind and sanity in my life? Because when we set boundaries, they're not for the other person. They're for us as individuals to protect us so that we can have a healthier, happy life. So I think this is one of the key areas in family recovery, because frequently we see a lot of unhealthy boundaries that have been part of how the family functions. So families need a lot of help in training and learning how to set boundaries and continuing to set healthy boundaries.
Okay, so what, you know, we going back to that, we were talking about the unwritten rules. You said the first one was sort of the no-talk rule, don't talk about the bigger issues and just the little deals. What's another one of those unwritten rules?
The other one is we're not going to openly express how we feel about things. So people start stuffing their feelings. They also stop trusting, not only trusting others in the family, but trusting themselves and their gut instincts. Addiction really throws people off, and so that it creates a lot of chaos and confusion in the family, and so these rules kind of, you know, it's real insidious how they evolve.
Okay, we got another caller on the line, Johnny.
Good morning. How are you?
Welcome. Thank you for calling in. What questions would you have for us today?
Well, I really enjoy the show, and your issue of boundaries kind of tickled a problem for me. I'm an attorney, and from time to time I'll have a client that may appear to have a serious substance abuse problem. Now, the Board of Professional Responsibility has put boundaries on what I can and can't say about my opinions of a client's tendencies to abuse either drugs, narcotics, alcohol, or whatever. But as a friend, you know, I also have concerns for my clients, and if I see self-destructive behavior, I would like to know what ways can I try to help my client without really stepping over that boundary that may be in place and really breaching a confidence of my client, but still being able to help them in a way.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing you can do is talk openly with your client about your concerns, particularly if their behavior is affecting your working relationship. You can always set a boundary that you're not willing to go any longer in the relationship until they get help. That's certainly within your ability to do so. I understand the constraints you have as far as confidentiality, but so you're kind of limited to the conversations you have with this client to openly addressing what you see going on and also perhaps having some solutions for them to look into. It's a difficult situation because of the confidentiality laws, I understand.
Yeah, I can't really do an intervention.
No.
Wow. I've had a lot of referrals for substance abuse in my treatment that, you know, the lawyers have requested that a substance abuse assessment be done as part of the case, but it's usually not the attorney, like direct attorney to their client. It's usually the opposing side that wants the assessment done. But I think it would still be possible that you could say, hey, I'd like for you to have this professional outside opinion just to help yourself, because you could be really working with some cases where people were sort of shooting themselves in the foot as far as progress in closing their case.
It can affect a lot of things, you know, custody issues and divorce matters, and then visitation, in terms of if there was an accident or injury situation, you know, we need to make sure that the client is clean before moving forward with some things.
Yeah,
I appreciate your show.
Thanks so much for calling in, Johnny.
Thank you.
It, okay, all right.
Okay.
Take care. Wow, Burr. It just makes me think as I listen to him speak that addiction just robs people of so much. If we could just think of it as a thief, you would never open the door and let a thief come into your house and take your stuff if it were that concrete of a scenario. But this is so insidious. So, you know, and I guess it happens in degrees. It's not like all at once you got, you know, the person just hit bottom within 3 days' time and development of addiction and then hitting bottom. It happens over years and years and years. And
sure.
You're looking that the intergenerational pattern of the family system and how it gets passed down.
Right.
So, but back to that, thinking about the rules, the unwritten rules. So, I'm, as you were saying, when people don't openly express their feelings, but I've seen some families that the only feeling they can really express is anger.
Sure, sure.
How do you deal with those families?
Yeah, the system itself is dominated by defenses. The family is in crisis, and not only are there problems with boundaries, but how the family eventually communicates, and this becomes very patternistic. We see looped communication where people keep having the same issues and addressing it in the same way with no clear resolution to the problems. And so it's kind of every day is the same, and it's chaotic and unpredictable with families living through this. I think the important thing, because we want to be solution-focused, is that families understand that as long as you stay accountable to these rules of addiction, the addiction's going to flourish. This is why we like to see people get professional help, because a professional will help address those things and help the family be able to see clearly what's happening to them. As this all is happening to them, they don't realize, how they've been adapting and compensating for addiction in their lives, because they're casually conditioned to it. Very much like you were talking about a minute ago.
Well, I tell my clients in my practice, I try to educate them about a term we call triangulation, which is kind of like the old game telephone in a way. People talk through others, and there's a lot of, not talking directly to the addict or to the person that you have the problem with.
Mm-hmm.
And that person that's drawn in between the original two is buffering the tension, but also they can't necessarily set boundaries for the person that needs to set them. And so, it gets kind of chaotic when you have a lot of that kind of indirect communication going on.
Yeah, we see that all the time.
Yes, yes. And I can imagine that could take up a lot of time in the intervention process, and that you would really have to channel that communication to a functional direction. But let's go to break again. Again, callers, I invite you to call in with any questions for Burr Cook of Family Intervention Now. The call-in number is 866-472-5792, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
The future of online TV is here. View exclusive content from your favorite talk radio hosts and new programs that you can't see anywhere else. Visit voiceamerica.tv today.
Please visit Rebecca's website at www.addictioninamerica.com to get more information on today's show, our guests, and other resources. The website contains a bookstore of material by various authors, musicians, and instructional videos to download. Applications for case management, referrals, and intervention can be made through the bookstore as well. Be sure to visit addictioninamerica.com. Addiction in America is here to help you take control of your life. The website again is www.addictioninamerica.com.
The Mayan calendar tells us that we will be entering into a 260-day opportunity for us to engage in conscious co-creation with Great Spirit. How will we prepare ourselves for this exciting and unprecedented time in Earth's history? Peter Tung has dedicated over 20 years of his life's work to exploring that which is beyond understanding. Peter will help increase your awareness and education on this enlightening transformation in consciousness. Awakening to Conscious Co-Creation airs live Wednesdays at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on Seventh Wave Network.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to Addiction in America with Rebecca Bullion. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to Rebecca at addictioninamerica.com. Again, that's Rebecca at addictioninamerica.com. Now, back to the show.
Well, hello again. This is Rebecca with Addiction America, and we've got Burr Cook of Family Intervention Now that we're interviewing today. And again, listeners, if you want to call in, the number is 866-472-5792, and we will entertain your questions. Right now, we want to continue talking about family systems, and where does a family start when they start to realize that, hey, there's a problem here, we've got to do something? What's the first step, Burr?
I think the first healthy thing a family can do is to reach outside of the system to get help. That they're part of an unhealthy system, and families tend to try to contain this and deal with it on their own. And shame is a big reason, and guilt, and they haven't been talking about things openly. So it's important for them to reach outside of the system, and it usually starts with a phone call to a professional in their community, to where they can start talking about their situation and seek some guidance. Not every family needs an intervention, but I think it's important, you being a therapist, you understand the value of families reaching outside to get the help they need outside of the family system. And then, secondly, a very important thing is to consistently take direction from the professionals. You know, we had a caller a couple calls back who was talking about her daughter wanting to do this. My experience is that addicts underestimate the power of their disease and overestimate their ability to deal with it. So as a general rule, I don't like to see addicts setting the parameters of their treatment. And so I think it's very important for families to stick with the guidance of a professional that they trust in guiding them through getting help.
Yeah, I think that would be really a fine balance as well for a treatment center, to not let the addict rule the treatment, but also to not give them a voice, so to speak, or let them, speak what's bothering them. Anyhow, going back to where do they start? So families need to reach out to a professional. How do people get in touch with you? If they wanted to call you for intervention?
They could go to my website, which is Burr Cook at Family Intervention Now, or they could just call me directly. I can give my number out. I can do it now if you like.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Yeah, my phone number is 949-903-3008. 903-3008, 949 area code. And
you're in California, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm in California. I work nationally and also have a lot of colleagues like yourself around the country, so that if we're not able to directly help somebody in the area they're in, we can certainly refer them to somebody in the area that can get them the help.
Right. That's part of our job as interventionists, is to know the treatment centers and, what they specialize in and, where they're located. And how would you I'm going to use the word interface or run interference between the treatment center and the addict and the family once the addict gets into treatment? What's your role then?
Well, once the addict gets into treatment, I'm pretty confident about the referrals I make, and I assume that a treatment center knows what they're doing in dealing with the addict. And so I certainly don't micromanage. My work tends to, at the point somebody enters treatment, I tend to put more energy and time into working with the family to ensure they're doing the work they need to do. Again, I like the idea of parallel recovery. While somebody's in treatment, that the family's doing their work. So that's where most of my attention goes to. And what I tell treatment centers is, if there's a problem, I certainly want to know about it. And if there's any way I can help, I certainly want to know about it. But I don't do a lot of interface with the treatment center while somebody's in treatment, unless there is a problem. Now, that being said, where I'm really interested in working with the treatment center and the family and the addict is just prior to discharge. so that, we can all collaborate and be on the same page with an effective continuing care plan. You know, what happens when a person leaves treatment really is the most important thing, and treatment center is going to prepare them for that. But you know, I like to be able to facilitate and guide the entire family through that process and that transition.
That reminds me of something that caller Joanne said about her daughter going to the sober living center, or the halfway house, I guess you call it. Mm-hmm. What are some of the benefits of going to that level of care after treatment?
Well, it's a place where they have more freedom in a sober living home, but they should have more responsibility too, particularly in the area of taking responsibility for their recovery, their ongoing recovery plan. So they have the ability to start to put some meaningful things in their lives, maybe employment, school, reconnecting with family to a certain degree, things that they weren't able to do in treatment. So they have the benefit of starting to put a life together, but doing it in a clean and sober environment where there's going to be some accountability and responsibility for them to take on. So it's a step down, but an important part of the process for many people.
It makes me think of the word safety.
Sure.
You know, the being in the treatment bubble of a treatment center, you don't have to deal with the outside world temptations, and that creates a safety. If the person goes straight home to, I guess what we call the old playmates, the old playgrounds, then there's a danger there. And especially if they go back to a family system that is not working on their stuff too, then there's a lot of triggers.
Sure, especially there, yeah. That's why we want to put so much effort into addressing the entire family system. You know, the intervention is, to my mind, Rebecca, and you can speak to this as well, is we kind of move from interventionist to family advocate, and so that, you know, we can support these families way beyond the intervention and helping them through these transitions, because it's rocky for many families post-treatment.
I imagine that a lot of the addicts would be angry at first, but do you get a lot of them coming later on saying, hey, thank you so much, you saved my life?
Yeah, most of them. They love me. I one of my goals is to establish a relationship with the addict that is a trusting relationship, so that they can look to me as an advocate. And that's many of the relationships I develop in these interventions is exactly that. So. You know, once a person's been treated, they can see the benefit of it, and it's always rewarding when they do come back and thank you, and I get those calls a lot. But also the calls of, hey, I have a question for you, or I've got a problem here, or I don't know what to do about this, and, you know, can you give me some guidance? And that's real meaningful when you get an addict calling, you know, asking for direction.
Oh, yeah. Well, listen, you know, we've got to close down the show here in about 4 minutes. And again, Burr, I want people to know how to get in touch with you. So your practice is called Family Intervention Now. And what was that phone number one more time?
The phone number is area code 949-903-3008. And I do work nationally. My website is Burr Cook at Family Intervention Now.
I know we got an email, just an affirmation from your friend David Cunningham at English Mountain Recovery in Tennessee. He's like, I love what you're doing. You know, thanks for having the show and, you know, talking about addiction. And we're going to have a lot of other speakers coming up here. We are going to have Dr. Ralph Carson next week to talk about his book, The Brain Fix, What's the Matter with Your Gray Matter, talking about addiction and recovery and what happens in the brain. It's going to be great. So I hope everybody will listen back in, and, you know, we take emails at Rebecca@addictioninamerica for any comments or feedback or questions regarding any of our shows. And of course, listeners can listen to the archives for you know, I know this is our second show and next week will be our third, but listen to the archives. And that's a great resource for anybody in the treatment field as well to send their listeners or their patients to. So, Burr, I thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And I just love what you're doing, Rebecca.
Oh, thank you, Burr. I'm enjoying it. This is great. So take care, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks, Rebecca.
Addiction in America.
Thank you for listening to Addiction in America. Please join Rebecca Bullion again next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Central Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Until our next program, have a good week, and may you be one step closer to conquering your addiction.
I'm having a hard time just trying to understand all the suffering, the misery that man goes through.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.